Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Panel, Timing and Implications of FDA-LDT Rule, Reforms to CLIA Regulations, Wider Use of Z-Code by Payers. The presenters are Session Chair, William Morris, MD, PhD, President and CEO, Mayo Clinic Laboratories, Rochester, Minnesota, Gabriel Bienwillner, MD, PhD, Chief Medical Officer, Palmetto GBA, Columbia, South Carolina, Tim Stenzel, MD, CEO, Gray Haven LLC, Crystal, Minnesota, and Lael White, Executive Chair and CEO, Shifin, Inc., San Diego, California.
And the really great talks, I think, set the stage for a lot of really good questions and discussion. We'll try and keep our comments brief to avoid permanent pupillary or ocular dysfunction from the lights in the back there. One of the questions that came to mind, that came up actually, and please submit on the WOVA app as well, because I'll be keeping track of that as I have been, and I noticed that Gabriel, for instance, has been answering some of the questions posed to him already online. But one of the questions that came up is to you was during your session, Dr. Bienwillner, but actually I think applies, that do you intend to accept FDA approval or New York State approval instead of MolDX review of clinical and analytical validity?
So I will say that in the past when labs have come to us and they've gone through FDA review, we've not really ever disagreed with what the FDA has said. But will it be a blanket acceptance? No. And one of the reasons for that is it depends on the language of the policy or process that we're trying to ensure the test is compliant with. So let's say that you have a test that comes in and the policy says this, the test performance must be as good as some standard. And let's say it goes through New York State. New York State thinks the test has some acceptable level of accuracy, but it's not as good as the standard that was defined in policy. And if that is the case, then that analytical validity would not be sufficient to comply with the stated policy. So it can't outright be accepted. That said, I doubt we would disagree most of the time.
Yeah, thanks. And I think one of the questions up for probably both you and Dr. Stenzel is just thinking about documentation and what kind of documentation we keep in the lab. I think there's a lot of variability. Do you think labs should, since there's going to be more and more requests from payers and from regulators for this type of information, do you think now is the time, if labs haven't already, is to invest in the infrastructure to have kind of standards? And you brought up, you know, analytical, clinical validity, clinical utility, to have those for each test in a way that they can provide it to different stakeholders with the testing process?
Well, I know Tim can weigh in here, but I would say that labs should already have that. Every service is put into production in a clinical laboratory by a medical director, laboratory director. They should have gone through the process of establishing the performance of that test, and there should be documentation that demonstrates that the director has reviewed all that data and has determined that it is acceptable. So when we ask for data, you should never be creating things. They should already exist. Now, it's true that not all labs are compliant with that, but that is the expected status.
Is my mic on? Yes, great. Well, the FDA looks at it a little bit different, though I think most good labs follow this practice. So when they talk about records, the key issue is they want to keep records of the original test and the original validation. They also want you to keep records of each iteration and the validation of those iterations and any revs to SOPs, that you keep those basically indefinitely as long as you are offering that test. The FDA is interested in the chain of evidence from the beginning all through the end or the current time to know that when a change is made, it doesn't harm performance, and you know exactly all the changes are documented. So I think most good labs already do that. That's just an explanation of why the FDA is interested in that. I would encourage, if there's not many questions online yet, to submit your questions. There's no bad question, and this is a great opportunity.
And so maybe I'll fill in with a question then. And for a lot of you, because really, you think about, there's going to be I agree completely. This is good practice. Having in my time as chair of the Department of Lab Medicine in Rochester at Mayo Clinic, you find that labs they all have the information, but oftentimes they haven't invested in standardizing so it's easily obtained. And I think particularly for older tests, it's something we're going to have to look at and make sure. I think it is our obligation to have that information, but we're going to have to make sure it's accessible. So that's just one of the things processes we'll need to invest in the laboratory. Lila, you mentioned also the payment side. I mean, you touched on PAMA. We do have looming the PAMA cuts if we do not get some legislative action. We did get another 1-year delay this year with ACLA as part of that with Susan Van Meter. But, what are your thoughts on SALSA? People should get very much engaged with SALSA. It's a Saving Access to Laboratory Services Act. Now, I don't know, there's not a CHIPS Act yet that goes with it, but what are your thoughts on the chances of SALSA being actually passed and also just thinking about payment to laboratories and recognizing the costs that go into producing a good test for a patient?
Yeah, I think that, SALSA does need to be passed. Obviously, the implementation of PAMA was one of the biggest problems, and the fact that the database used to collect data wasn't sufficient. And so from that perspective and from the perspective of capping some of the fee increases at a much lower level than PAMA currently allows, would be fairly substantive and important for the lab industry to have. But as far as, reimbursement is concerned, again, I think the reimbursement exercise that we went through wasn't giving us really market-based pricing. And a lot of tests are still mispriced, some below cost, some significantly over cost. And, maybe they balance each other out for a lab with an extensive menu. But for specialty labs, that's not necessarily the situation. So still some work has to be done. But I think coverage is becoming more and more of an issue than even reimbursement is becoming an issue. And that is that, even if the FDA moves forward with the LDTs, they're really focused on clinical and analytical validity more than anything else. Clinical utility still has to be proven after even FDA approval. And, certainly the MolDX program has gone a long way in getting that kind of criteria more standardized. But that's still a dilemma that labs face with private payers, commercial payers, Medicare, Medicaid, for a variety of newly introduced tests. So the clinical utility piece is the tough part, requires a lot of data, a lot of information, publications, peer-reviewed publications and things of that nature, all substantive costs to a lab. So we'll be adding the FDA cost on top of the already clinical utility costs that labs have to go through to get tests actually covered in many years. So this extends both the period of time, I think, that it is required for a test to actually even get covered, FDA approval followed by clinical utility approval, and then reimbursement, kind of follows. Now, even with PAMA, I think newly introduced tests have a better chance of getting a market price because they're newly introduced, haven't really developed a history yet. So better chance of getting a good price, market price for new tests than existing tests. But at the same time, the coverage criteria and the types of coverage reviews that payers are now introducing are making it much, much harder to get reimbursed.
Yeah, it's a real challenge for sure. And I have another question, but I want to make sure we keep the whole panel engaged. And so, Tim, this is one, I think, for you, and it's kind of probably top of mind for just about everybody in this. What's your recommendation and how an organization best meets the challenges expected with the new FDA ruling? Final rule, I should say.
So read the rule. Have somebody within your system or lab that is in charge of, regulatory. Some, it doesn't have to be full-time. I think this rule really lowers the regulatory burden. You don't have to be, have the brightest mind in the industry now. I think you have core, solid people who can read and follow the rules to tell you how you stay in compliance and out of trouble. I don't think it has to be a super high-level person because, in the end, the bar is pretty low here. I think the most The biggest challenge is really knowing which compliance, QS compliance levels you're going to be expected to follow for your tests, depending on the pathway you get to be allowed to be on the market with your test, whether it's, you know, under one of, you know, if it's under the, one of the exemptions except for going to the FDA, which would ultimately probably require more compliance efforts. But it could be as simple as, you know, your records retention plan and making sure that if the FDA comes in ever, which is highly unlikely, that you're, everything's in order. And it's really, even though it's maybe not as friendly as a CLIA inspection sometimes is or collegial, I've been inspected when I was in industry and responsible for the FDA relationship for many years, and I never had a problem with the agency that we couldn't solve, just because I always had great teams and we knew how to do things and we did it well. So, I think there is going to be a ton of questions that everybody's going to have about what this rule means for their specific situation. I do encourage, so Toby Lowe, there's an email to get a hold of Toby Lowe in the final rule. I work closely with Toby for many years. She's awesome. She's probably got a team of people that is going to try to answer all your questions as soon as possible. That's going to be free. Hopefully that turnaround time for your questions will be quick. The shorter your questions, the fewer the questions, the faster the turnaround time. And then there's also the free QSub pre-sub program. I think the FDA is going to be very busy answering a lot of specific questions, just so all of you, you know, can feel secure in how the rule applies to your situation and is relatively complex, much more complex than the proposed rule in understanding it as it applies to you, but it's much less complex once you know that to meeting everything.
So understand the rule first and foremost, and then translate it to your specific laboratory, and then reach out for help with that as you try and solve that abacus. And I would say, the other thing, if you are, have the advantage of being an institution that has a blood donor center, particularly if it's in your academic department, which is in Rochester, and they actually are used to, you know, there are pockets within laboratory medicine that are, have a history and understand how to respond to FDA. It is a different animal than CLIA for sure, or CAP inspection, but yes, I totally agree. I guess another question, Tim, it's, and to kind of bring back what Dr. Salerno was speaking to, any thoughts on how this legislation, or really it's not legislation, it's rule making, will interact with the public health emergency where the CDC is involved?
You know, Ren could do this very well. He's probably more up to date than I am since I retired at the end of 2023. But there's two new guidances relative to this. The FDA was required to issue one of those guidances to explain how they would potentially use enforcement discretion in a future pandemic. We should all be a little bit concerned about avian flu, obviously, and I certainly was very concerned about it when I was the agency before I left. And so that just lays out so that there's a method laid out that the FDA would use. So we used a lot of enforcement discretion at the beginning of COVID, you know, starting on February 29th, saying laboratory developed tests didn't have to be reviewed at the FDA prior to them being used on patients. That was a huge shift from prior EUA stances. And there are some out there who thought that was pretty extreme to allow that. So powers to be wanted the FDA to come out with a guidance. It just lays out how the FDA would approach certain future situations. And then the other guidance is related to public health labs and the systems. And anybody associated with the CDC and tasked with developing tests for potentially emerging disorders. So one would expect that a good agency like the CDC, for example, in their lab network might be thinking about avian flu and wanting to have a specific avian flu, you know, test that could be used now for public health purposes, but potentially useful for an EUA. What the rule says, though, is that all the EUA you know, prior rules, other than these kind of exceptional situations, really is going to apply still. The FDA, when it's critical to human health in a pandemic situation, they want to make sure that the tests are really good and that they will function as claimed, and that the American people can depend on it.
Yeah, thanks. And I would also say that, you know, we had representation from the CDC at our American Clinical Laboratory Association annual meeting, and there's, I think, a real, one of the things going forward is a commitment from the CDC, as Ren spoke to, of continuing to codify these public and also private partnerships in this response. We, you know, it came up, of course, during COVID and then again during monkeypox, and the public health labs and the private labs, our labs, are very complementary in responding to some of these things. So it's, and then interacting with the FDA as well in turn around the regulation for this. And so let me see here. There was a question that came up that I want to see if I can't find it. This really could kind of fit back into the reimbursement. Do you anticipate health plans following suit and requiring FDA approval for reimbursement?
I mean,
you go first.
It's a reimbursement question. So, you know, coverage and reimbursement are separate concepts than regulatory frameworks. Could a health plan say we will only reimburse services that have gone through FDA approval? Yeah, I guess they could do that. Would Medicare do that? No, I don't believe that they would. Now, if the regulatory framework requires the lab to have gone through a process and that process has not been met, well, then that's a problem, right? So obviously that would be an issue. But given that there's a lot of ways potentially to be compliant, I don't believe that Medicare would require, let's say, a higher standard or a formal 510K or something review when they could go through some other regulatory means, if that addresses the question.
I can also mention that, you know, I think in my presentation I talked about 15% of the denials for covered tests that would be covered under the Medicare program are being denied for non-coverage, which falls under various categories, including potential FDA approval for future reference. And I think I would see commercial payers actually utilizing the FDA coverage or FDA approval as part of that process in, you know, future years. So we could probably see that coming down the pike because they're already doing it to a certain extent.
I do want to make one kind of comment on this as somebody who represents payers to some degree, and I work a lot with these commercial programs as well. Oh, thank you. Did anyone hear what I was saying before? Just reflecting general payer concepts here. While it may always seem that payers just don't want to pay for anything, it's not usually the case. I will say in general, my feeling is that payers just don't understand stuff, and what that complexity makes them out of hand, sort of just not want to pay for things they don't get and they don't understand. I think having a data set that everyone agrees is some sort of truth might make things, it's not going to solve all the problems for sure. And certainly, yes, corporate greed and these things will have a hand in it, but I think it'll help result in more consistency between coverage policies between different, I think that's a big issue we haven't talked about, right? You can have different payers with very different policies. And part of it is they don't just agree on what the facts are. And as we get to more shared facts, whether it's gone through FDA review or it's gone through MolDX, and these things I think will ultimately help kind of heal some of these issues.
Yeah, I'll add a few things. So my frustrations with reimbursement began when I was director of the molecular lab I opened at Duke. And the first FDA-approved test that I brought into my lab was HPV. This is mid-90s, so soon after it was approved. You know, it was a 10,000-page patient study. It very clearly showed, we all knew that 95%+ of, you know, cervical cancer patients had HPV in their DNA. This is an obvious test to run, so I brought it up. And then we say, okay, we brought it up. We go to Blue Cross Blue Shield. And they say, nope, we're not going to reimburse it. And I'm like, what? So FDA clearance and approval alone, I learned a hard lesson immediately upon taking over a lab, was not sufficient to get reimbursement. So the missions are different, and the challenges exist through to today. Yeah, right now I don't think payers can, you know, and then with this rule, I mean, lab does, you know, if lab goes to New York State, that's some level of review, but it's not FDA approved. And so I think there's going to continue to be a challenge and a need for people like Gabe and his team to review analytical and clinical validity and then also make the necessary and reasonable assessment of tests. But if, you know, if payers know that at least it passed the FDA, they don't have to worry so much about whether the test is accurate, and then they can focus on necessary and reasonable.
Got it. Yeah, thank you. That's a great answer. So, Lila, in your talk at the beginning, I think you mentioned a few phrases that I'm sure caught the attention of many in the audience. One was around, you know, labs are not a commodity, right? And the other was around the decision support points, both at the time of order entry and at the time of delivering the results in terms of clinical actions. Those sort of the core components for, there's a number of individuals, myself included, that would think that the holy grail for lab testing reimbursement would not be on a fee-for-service model, but I'm more on a value-based model and the value that they create for the clinical care episode and being rewarded for that in some way. Do you think that's something that's feasible, or is that more of a pipe dream?
I think it's feasible, but it takes a lot of documentation and information to actually get there, because you have to kind of prove that the physician really did change their therapy decision or the decision to order a test on the basis of some good analytics, and that the outcome was better. So you have to go all the way to the outcome. And that's been part of the problem with value-based pricing for laboratories, is having the level of data and sophistication to get to a point where you can prove that the assay actually made a difference in the outcome and in the cost structure. So these are very important elements that make it difficult. Also, we see a lot of bundling in value-based care, where it's bundled with other services, and laboratory kind of gets short shrifted at the end of that for any kind of adequate reimbursement. But in essence, and you know, these are papers that have been written for years, value-based pricing makes a lot of sense for laboratory diagnostics as it does for pharmaceuticals. I mean, what is the outcome of to the patient? But it's all a matter of the right level of data and analytics that can prove that out. And I think it can be an excellent component for reimbursement for laboratories, because I think labs contribute, you know, significantly to the health outcome of any patient. That diagnostic is a fairly significant thing. And we saw one value-based study in Florida that was really interesting, where the laboratory, instead of negotiating like as a percentage of what laboratory costs in the total healthcare spectrum, like maybe lab is 3% of the cost, so they get 3% of the reimbursement for good outcomes in a bundled service, they actually made the argument that no, it should be based on the savings and how much the lab contributed to that versus how much the overall lab cost is. And that was a great value-based study that was done and implemented and really brought a lot of good, you know, value-based pricing criteria to diagnostics.
Yeah, great. Any other thoughts from the fellow panelists?
I just think that the concepts of value-based, it just adds one additional level of additional value that has to be demonstrated, that clinical utility, it's just going to make things much more difficult and hard to implement.
You know, as a lifelong laboratorian, you know, IVD developer, LDT developer, you know, I think what we do is incredibly valuable to patients. And our work is way undervalued. Now, proper utilization is important. You should do the right test on the right patient at the right time. But we don't get the credit so that we can, especially when you are in a lab and running a lab and keep the lights on and keep staff happy, you know, to have a livable wage, all those things, you know, those are important. And we as a lab community have been, you know, siloed off and not integrated. You know, I've been studying, you know, BNP, for example, and its ability to keep patients out of the hospital for, you know, heart failure prevention. I mean, it's an incredibly important marker. you know, having BNP available in all a health system's clinics so that you can get an immediate result would, I believe, save a lot of money. It's going to cost some money, but it's going to save a lot more. And then think about if you can get that test in the hands of a patient at home, just like the diabetics who can monitor their blood sugars at home, you give them a tool to monitor their weight and the effectiveness of their diet program to keep them out of heart failure, and I think you reap a lot of benefits. And, you know, everybody involved, I mean, that should be a connected system so the patient's clinician can track their BNP results and get paid to monitor their, I mean, get paid to keep them out of the hospital. So we're way undervalued. That is a long-term problem, and I would love to see that solved.
Yeah. I think it boils down, I agree completely, and that, you know, it boils down to, you know, when we talk about data as a laboratory and from a medical scientific perspective, we often think about the test results, you know, and the accuracy, all the things that we've talked about here. But really to address some of these things, we also have to think more holistically around data, kind of widen the aperture to think about, you know, getting access to outcome data, getting access to prevalence data, getting access to other things that will be required for us to systematize some of these things. And that all goes to data architecture, which I can't believe I'm actually, as someone that did horrible math in school, I'm up here talking about data architecture, so I probably should stop just about now with that and get to the next topic. There's top vote getting question is one I'm sure that I knew would catch people's attention. That's for you, Tim. Can you explain what you meant when you said it's possible no LDT lab may have to submit to the FDA? I think I get it because I was really engaged around valids and I understand that balance, but I'll let you take that one.
Thank you for that question. I hoped that I would get that question. So, all right. So, you know, if you're any sort of sizable reference lab and you have LDTs, most of them are you have a New York certified lab and most of your LDTs are New York State approved because you can't ignore that population. You know, if you're New York State approved and you maintain that, you don't launch any tests before you get at least provisional approval, you're good. But a lot of, you know, in-state, you know, healthcare systems, both academic and private, may not, you know, bother with New York State because they don't get samples from New York State, so they don't have to get it. And it is a pretty big hurdle. I ran a lab once that had gotten New York State approval, and we were successful, but it was substantially harder than, you know, preparing for a CLIA inspection, and the test submission process was not easy as well. I mean, it's much easier than the FDA. So that's one whole category. Some, you know, way north of 90% of all major reference lab LDTs are New York State approved. So those don't come in. And then they can, you know, fill in the gap and get New York State approval. But, you know, health systems that have a lab integrated and that lab serves just their population and they're not performing a reference lab business outside of their population, they don't have to come in either. So what are the, you know, the DOD doesn't have to come in. You know, you can really, it's hard to find an example where someone doesn't have an option other than coming to the FDA for even a class 3 device. My initial reading of the rule, I'm still going through the details, though.
Yeah, it's 520-some pages, so, yeah, it's not a lot of time. But to get through that, I would just add, from my perspective, as the chair of the ACLA board, you know, I was quite involved when the Valid Act was it's still introduced, actually, but when it was really in the end of 2022 when was trying to get into the omnibus with Senator Burr. I mean, I think, to your point, it contained a lot, you know, the legislative approach was to get more stakeholder engagement And I think one of the things we can take solace with is that a lot of things that were in that legislation are actually reflected in this final rule, and in some respects are actually even easier to implement. I think that's kind of was to your point. So I think the most important thing is we have to, you know, there's the gut response of, oh my gosh, I can't believe this actually happened. We've been talking about it for decades. But the flip side is to really dig in and understand it's going to take a little time and how it really applies to you. So, Gabe, there is a question for you here. There were a couple. One was on yours as well, which I think was an interesting one about, you know, what type of evidence and publications can be used when submitting for Z-code. And then when private payers want to require Z-code with CPT code on claim, is payer asking for a slightly different set of requirements when Z-code is applied and issued by originating lab compared to Medicare MolDX? I think I get that, but I'm not sure I totally get that.
I may have to read that second one. It wasn't clear what the...
So it's basically when private payers want to require Z-code and a CPT code on a claim, are they asking for really different sets of information?
So the Z-code does not replace a CPT code. It adds additional information regarding the specifics of that unique service. There has to be a CPT code on the claim as well. You can't just use a Z-code and an ICD-10 code. If there's a requirement for Z-code, you need ICD-10 code, CPT code, and the Z-code. The one major difference is very important to point out is that there's not a CPT code for every service. And many LDTs that don't have a CPT code that defines that service. So with a Z-code, you can use 81479, and it's very clear to the payer exactly what you did. Without the Z-code, it's almost impossible to know what it is that you did, which is why private payers and Medicare contractors outside of the MolDX program universally hate 81479. And most labs are sort of trained as a result to not want that code because they think it implies that they're not going to get paid, which is often true. But in the context of using these data, now that's no longer true at all. You may get even preferential pricing because we can evaluate this specific service and what its value is in a way that can't be done. And what often happens without the use of the Z-code is either A, labs sort of compile a bunch of CPT codes together to try to approximate the pricing that they want, whether they make sense or not. Or B, payers even sometimes tell the provider to bill the wrong code purposefully just to get it through this process. We can kind of ignore both of those things with the use of the Z-code. I think I addressed the question. Yeah. I'm not sure.
I think you did as well. And the other question, which I think is related, is just, you know, the logic of the Z-code makes good sense. How many labs have successfully completed the technical assessment, the TA?
I don't have an exact number, but we've been doing this for a long time. We've reviewed over 20,000 tests. The number of labs that have successfully gone through this process is in the thousands.
So lots.
Lots.
Got it. So let me go back to the other questions now. I'm trying to hop around on my app and not have a complete, totally public technical failure here. See if I can pull that off, because there are a lot of good questions continue to come in. There's one here that I think really might take up. Well, there's one question I want to ask first, and then a question that I think a theme that's coming from the questions. So the first one's around data, and, you know, Dr. Solano talked about data as a specimen, and I think the question. There's a lot of now, especially with large language models becoming so rapidly advanced, the thoughts of the panel on the use of large language models on top of lab data to create interpretations or results. Will that be, you know, what's the business model for that to get reimbursed? Will it get reimbursed? Number one. And number two, how do you anticipate that might get regulated as well?
Let me start from a payer perspective and as a molecular pathologist and physician response. I would be very cautious here. So there's often labs, I think, misinterpret or misuse the word interpretation. And the interpretation is done by a physician based on the result of a test. Sometimes for a complex test, labs build algorithms that can be used to look at that data and help in the administration of a result or to add additive information that's annotative to that result. So think about an NGS test with an EGFR mutation, and then there's a database that spits out, oh, this EGFR mutation is sensitive to erlotinib. That is not an interpretation. An interpretation is, my patient has lung cancer, it's stage 3, this result is EGFR, I should do X, right? So what do you, when you mean that the interpretation is done by AI, are you saying, or these complex deep learning algorithms, that it's yielding that kind of result? Okay, let's assume that's what you mean. Or a pathway of which test should be ordered, or a, you know, what should be the drug that's given as a result of this test. The question is, who takes responsibility? If the AI gives the wrong answer, which, by the way, will happen, is not the doctor who didn't make that decision. And I'm sure the company who makes this AI said, hey, I wrote a little, there's a little disclaimer at the bottom saying that it's just a recommendation, right? So what does interpretation mean? I would be very cautious. The other thing I would say is as a payer, the reimbursement. What is the covered benefit that's being done here? What is it compared to? If this is doing the same thing we're already paying a physician to do, don't expect to get paid more than the physician gets to do that same exact thing, A. But B, is this even a covered benefit? For example, under Medicare, Medicare program pays for things only that are covered benefits under the program. Where does a piece of software fit in that? It's not clear that it fits anywhere. So for now, I would say it's not clear that we would reimburse this at all because it may not be a covered benefit.
Got it. Other thoughts from the panel? No, I think it's going to be a tricky. I agree with you completely, Gabe. It's a kind of the brave new world. We can write these interpretive, if you're loose on the interpretation of interpretation, that these can be introduced, but how you do it safely, how you demonstrate where it adds value, how you think about that is all going to be things that evolve, but it's going to be something, I think most important, going back to you, with you, Lila, for us in the laboratory, I think we just always have to be vigilant that 70% of the quantitative data in the health record is coming out of the lab. And so that's really going to be a focal point for anyone, even outside the lab, that's thinking about writing these algorithms. So to really stay engaged becomes really important. So last question, I think, for the panel here, because this is a theme that's coming through, and the theme you brought it up first is innovation, right? And, of course, now with the FDA final rule, there's another, will this impede innovation? I would argue that the impediments to innovation are actually multifactorial in terms of it's not just the regulatory part, but it's the reimbursement part as well, right? And so you need the whole ecosystem to make the innovation accessible to patients. We live in a time where science is rapidly advancing. Just your thoughts on how we participate in either the regulatory side or the reimbursement side or both to make sure that we can keep innovation strong for the laboratories. Maybe Tim, I'll let you start.
Yeah, my concern. So, my belief is that the FDA and the current leadership at the FDA are very interested in innovation and stimulating it, not just in, traditional kit manufacturer companies, but also labs. I mean, we highly as a nation depended on, lab developed tests for, for COVID. For Mpox, and it was a great working relationship between the FDA, CDC, and the major reference labs dealing with the Mpox outbreak. We learned a lot of lessons from COVID. We enlisted a lot of, support from key players, so I said the bar, I think, in this rule is very low. And extremely reasonable, and there should be no, even though the FDA is interested in innovation and would work with anybody who wants to come to the FDA, the only thing they care about is the test accurate, and is it properly validated so they can tell it's accurate. I think, my experience with the FDA over the years with multiple, scores of dozens of examples of successful submissions, For me, working with the FDA was always highly predictable. I knew what to do to validate a test and to submit it properly and, you know, and get it, you know, and get it a cleared or approved. And I think the FDA is also interested in helping with the FDA with the payer community. They do have a payer program now. So they know that it does nobody any good if they approve or clear all this innovative technology, but it doesn't get reimbursed, so it doesn't get utilized. So it's been a frustration at the FDA for a long time, in my opinion.
Thanks. Yeah, and cognizant that we are standing between you guys and lunch, maybe just to wrap, but I am interested, Gabe, just because you're and also that Robert's joined the stage, so the shepherd's hook is out. Gabe, you see a lot of the information that people are submitting, right? And is there, what would you be your recommendation for people that are submitting for like Z-codes? But do you see that the documentation is consistent in terms of judging whether the innovation meets the parameters that you're looking for?
Usually when we're talking about innovation, something that isn't already covered under policy, by rule, but under the 21st Century Cures Act, expansion of coverage to something new also requires policy, which means the coverage will only come with published evidence that demonstrates AV, CV, and CU. If you come looking for coverage and you haven't met those three things, you will not get it. You will need to have peer-reviewed, published evidence. And let me also, there was another question I'm going to address here as an adjunct to this. Just having a paper does not mean that you've met some criteria for clinical utility or clinical validity. We're going to review the actual experiments that were done to look at what the conditions were and whether you've really satisfied or really convincingly demonstrated clinical validity and clinical utility. Analytical validity, I usually say, is not something you have to publish. In fact, most papers don't really care about that or won't. It's not a high priority. You can demonstrate that, but with just filling out a spreadsheet and explaining what you did. But clinical validity, clinical utility really require that you do a thorough evaluation, set up an appropriate experiment, go through this process. Make sure that you do that. Now we're talking about innovation. If you're doing the same thing a 1,000 other labs have done, like an NGS test for cancer, you don't need to publish anything. You can just demonstrate that you're equivalent performance to those existing services. The other thing, let me just comment and flip that around on the payers. I think one issue that we have with payers is the goal of the medical director for a payer is to evaluate evidence and determine whether these reasonable and necessary or medical necessity thresholds are met. I will tell you, outside of the MolDX program, most directors really just punt this stuff. They usually either punt it to like a established guideline or to some third-party review system like Hayes. And I think that's very unfortunate because it makes it very difficult for a really innovative company to bring this information to those payers and have them really evaluate the evidence that you've created. They're very likely to just say, come back when this is in the current guidelines, and that may be in 10 years down the road when the guidelines are updated. So it's a problem.
Thank you. And I guess, Lila, you'll have last word on this.
So from a business perspective, it's kind of important to understand what innovation actually means. Labs operate at a very, very small margin. You can see this in public company labs and genetic labs. You'll see them operating at a negative margin for years and years and years. And when you have a tight economy like the one we have now, investors are not readily willing to invest in laboratories when they know that you can't patent a test very effectively without it being obsolete in a very short period of time and being undone by some other new test. So when we talk about innovation, we have to understand the cost associated with innovation and the cost associated with reimbursement, proper reimbursement. And spending years and years of time getting a test approved, reimbursed, and recognized is something that's very difficult in an industry where it's not patentable like a drug for 30 years. And so investment is tight in our industry as a result of that. And the profit margins are very tight. So there has to be a balance to all of this. And while everything in theory is terrific, and we want safety and guidance and FDA approval on all of this, we have to understand the cost structure that we're introducing into a scenario where margins are already quite lean. And so these are all parts of the balance that have to be considered in any regulatory efforts that move forward and what that innovation means basically to healthcare ultimately. We are probably the last nation left that has the level of innovation that we have in it, because our structure supports a lot more innovation than various other economies in other countries. But essentially that can be lost pretty easily if we're not very, considerative and collaborative about how these things need to be rolled out.
Well, that's excellent last word. I'd like to thank my panelists for a really great discussion and for your time and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Dr. Maurice. I think he did a very capable job. Let's give the panel and Dr. Maurice a wonderful hand.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.